Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 16 of Tim's Travails. This is a wonderful podcast by an IP attorney who has amazing international reach and talking about such fascinating topics with people that he knows in his life and in his career. Today is no exception. We are talking with children's book author and journalist Karen Leggett Abaraya. The topic is what it means to write well, and she has written one of my favorite children's books called Zam Zam. She is surrounded by writers and writing since her youth. Her father was a journalist, her mother a school librarian. She is an award-winning broadcast journalist and has such amazing stories to tell. So I'm going to turn it over to Tim. Thank you so much, both of you, for being here. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show. Take it away, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Hope. And Karen, thank you very much for agreeing to be on the podcast. So it's good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, it's a little different because obviously when I do write, it's not in the area of children's books. So for me, this is a little bit interesting and different. And the question becomes, as being a professional journalist, how do you go from being a journalist to a children's book author? You know, what's that transition or what's the motivation that gets you from there to there? You know, it's interesting to me.
Well, it really wasn't a plan. It wasn't a goal. It was a door that opened, and I walked through, and haven't regretted it in the least. And in some ways, they are connected. As a children's book author, my books are primarily nonfiction, and of course, that's what I was writing as a radio journalist. And also on the radio, we are always looking to get the essence of a story. I had to take very complicated stories, and of course, there's a lot of jokes about this, and turn it into a 40-second soundbite. Yeah. And essentially, that's what a children's book does as well. It can take a very complicated subject and tell it, not simplistically, but for an audience that is young and may not have as much experience as adult readers.
Yeah.
And that's part of what writing well, as Hope was mentioning, that's part of what writing well means is understanding your audience, motivating that audience, and getting that audience to feel a chill or an excitement or simply a desire to turn the page. And that's a goal, whether you're writing thrillers for adults or whether you're writing nonfiction for children.
Yeah. Well, that surprises me in some way because you say you're focused on nonfiction, and I guess I always think of children's books more in the fiction realm, shall I say?
Well, and there is something now called narrative nonfiction, and it's where in a sense that sounds contradictory, but it's where you take a nonfiction event and write it as if it were a novel.
Okay.
And sometimes that requires, sometimes you may make up small bits of dialogue, for example, but the main essence of the story is nonfiction. So my first nonfiction book was Hands Around the Library.
Mm-hmm.
And the library is the ancient library in Alexandria, Egypt. Now it's the modern library. And this is a story that actually happened in 2011, 2012, during the Arab Spring, when protesters literally held hands around the library in Alexandria to protect it because there's a lot of glass walls and they were worried that vandals might come and be throwing stones or rocks and break the glass. Yeah. So it was a nonfiction story about, and these were students, but they weren't little kids who were protesting. They were mostly college students. So I wanted to tell this story in a sense of how important it was to love your library.
Yeah.
And how these people demonstrated it. But I had to make it a story that was interesting for young kids. My books tend to be written for third to fifth graders.
Okay.
So I needed to write for that audience to make it understandable, the events and the language. I didn't want to write down to them, but I wanted to make this story understood to them. And there are a lot of young adult authors who write books about the Cold War, about the civil rights struggle, about life as a gay person, all sorts of books that are nonfiction, but that are written in a narrative fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So they're exciting. So they're exciting exciting to read.
Yeah. And I guess one thing I'm curious about is, as you think about doing this, did you yourself have to read several books like this, or go to workshops or anything like that to prepare yourself to write a book like this?
Well, we did. I was actually collaborating on this with the illustrator. The illustrator is, and I'm going to show the book again because it's all collage,
mm-hmm.
and cut paper collage. And she, it's Susan L. Roth. We became friends before we became collaborators. That doesn't happen very often in children's books. Often the author doesn't even know the illustrator. We did. And she, she visited Egypt. My husband is Egyptian, so I'd mm-hmm. visited Egypt a lot. She visited Egypt and wanted to write a book about Egypt. And she visited the library, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous structure right on the Mediterranean Sea in Alexandria. And she came home and said, well, we have to write a book about the library. And we thought, okay, we'll write a story of the ancient library and bring it up to the modern day. And that's what we wrote. So yes, there was a lot of research to find out about the ancient library, to find out as much as I could. It disappeared, and there are all sorts of legends about what happened to the original library, but I could tell the story of the new library. And so, yes, there was a lot of research, and the book includes what we call back matter, which is resources and other books and places to find that. Well, as it turned out, real life intervened. While we were writing this story, the incident that mm-hmm. that we tell about in the book, where the protesters held hands around the library, that happened while we were writing it. And we figured, okay, we'll end it. That'll be the dramatic ending to our book. And that's the way we wrote it. And we sent it to an editor, and the editor came back and said, that's fine. All we want is the story of that protest. They didn't want any of the history. So we essentially had to start all over again.
Yeah.
And write a whole, and now all of that history is in the back matter. You get all that at the end of the book for teachers and for parents and for older kids who want to read that and find out all about that ancient library. Mm-hmm. But the book itself is just the story of that protest and how they loved the library, why they loved it, why it was important, why they protested. So we had to rewrite. You know, we started out with one manuscript and ended up with something totally different.
Well, sometimes, you know, I mean, I think that happens no matter what you write, right?
And that may happen for you have a chapter and that.
Yeah. Well,
I don't want that chapter. So then you have to figure out a new way to get from.
Yeah. I mean, it's either that or as the writer yourself, you go, well, I don't, you know, I thought this is the beginning, which, by the way, I mean, my last book, I'd written about 25 pages thinking that was going to be the beginning of the book. And I guess one day, you know, every once in a while, I'll be on the treadmill and thoughts pop into my head. And I thought, I need something more active at the beginning. And so obviously I saved those 25 pages, but now they don't really show up in the book now until about page 60 something, because I ended up with a completely different beginning of the book. So it's 60 pages in before you even get to what I thought was going to be the beginning. And, you know, I think that happens to anybody, any of us that kind of spend our time writing things for other people to read. And you have to rethink, how's this coming across to the reader? And in your case, how did the editor see it? And they have a completely different plan in their head as to the way the book should be. And
There's a very interesting article in the current issue of Atlantic called "The Age of Reading is Over," and of course that title, it's a very distressing thing. But she talks in part about writers and writing, and she makes a very interesting comment that, and this is where she begins talking about AI, which is a whole another discussion. But what she says is that the writing process is how writers solve their problems and think through a problem and think through an issue, just as you did. You needed to write those first 25 pages to think about your topic, to work through. And then you were able to get back and write what turned out to be really the beginning.
Yeah.
But writing is work, and you have to work through the phrases and work through the ideas.
Absolutely.
That's what makes writing a challenge and not simply, and a lot of people, of course, think writing a picture book is easy. You know, it's what, 600 words and you can sit and write that with a snack in the afternoon. Well, it's not. It's probably harder than writing a long book because you do have to condense so many ideas into.
Well, that leads to a couple of the other questions I have, because since you're writing, you said, for third to fifth graders, and I'm thinking from an age perspective, maybe 8-9 years old to about 11.
Correct. That's right.
And so then the question becomes, well, you know, is there a guide, shall we say, for length and those kinds of things? Because it's got to be interesting, but also not so long that they're not going to take it upon themselves to go through a thick book.
There's no fixed rules on that. There are guidelines. And usually what anyone, if you're taking a class on writing children's books, the first advice is to go read children's books.
Yeah.
So sit in the children's section and whatever you think you want to write, picture book, middle grade, read as many as you can. Read the really best ones. Read the award winners, the Newbery, the Caldecott, that all the localists, all the local winners. Read those books. They're the best out there. And that gives you an idea. Most of them, a picture book is a standard picture book is 32 pages. So you guys, so you know. Now that can mean, you know, there are a few people who write marvelous books with no words at all. They just do illustrations. And there are others who cram as many words as they can into those 32 pages. And there have been sort of award winners on both ends.
Right.
You probably want to try, you know, if you're actually learning to do this or try doing this, you sort of want to hit in the middle somewhere. And there are lots of ways to learn to do it. We have right here in Bethesda, the Writers Center, which has some outstanding teachers for both adult writers as well as people writing for children.
Yeah.
And the Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, SCBWI, is a major national organization with very strong local chapters. Mm-hmm. And they have lots of webinars and courses on everything from getting the idea to drawing the pictures to writing it to submitting it, the whole thing. If you have any aspirations to write for kids, that's the organization to join.
Well, it sounds to me it's a bit interesting, because I remember the first time I actually had written through a novel manuscript. And then I went to the writer centers that you just mentioned. I did take a class. And after that, then I picked up a few books on how to write a novel. And I thought to myself, if I had read those books first, I would never have even tried.
there is that. It can be discouraging. That's right.
Yeah. So I was kind of happy I had not read the books on how to write a novel before I actually had sat down and wrote the first one. Because those books, I would have walked away and just said, I'm not even going to bother. I mean, and it can be that way.
It's better. Did you take any of the classes at the Writers Center? Because I think when you have a person in person encouraging rework this paragraph. Usually they're not standing there and saying, forget it, you're never going to be a writer. They're usually trying to draw something out.
I wrote the whole manuscript. Then I took the class. Okay. Then I read the books. So I did it in an order that most people would not do things. I also think maybe, well, this is just me. I think it helps that I was in a profession that I read, not reading books, but reading professionally. But lawyers write. I mean, it may be boring junk, but lawyers do a lot of writing and reading. So to try and write it and then read other stuff isn't so difficult. It's just... you know, a little bit of self-teaching, shall we say. Yes, we go read other books and so on. And what it sounds like to me is when you have to sit down in the children's section of the bookstore and go through a bunch of books, it is self-taught, right? In a lot of ways.
It is, that's right.
Yeah.
And you get an idea. You know, everyone will tell you, oh, I've got a great story about my child or my grandchild or whatever. And some of them are quite good, but not all of them.
Yeah.
And I think you get an idea of what works and what doesn't when you're telling a story for other people to read.
Mm-hmm.
I did that. I'm a little guilty of writing my own story. My current book is Zam Zam. Mm-hmm. And Zam Zam is the nickname for our grandson. And this is the story of a little boy who has grandparents in Egypt and America. So it is it's certainly a personal story. And a lot of this, I tell children when I talk to them, I said, most of the incidents that happened in this book either happened to my son or my grandson. But there's a universality, particularly in the United States, to the notion of people from different countries marrying and having children so that their children have a cultural background. In our case, our children and grandchildren have a cultural background in the United States and in Egypt. And that's when I was speaking to a class of third graders here in Rockville, Maryland. And I asked, how many of you have a relative in another country?
Yeah.
And about a third of the kids, and there were probably 100 kids there, and there were about a third of them raised their hand.
Yeah.
And it was all different. I mean, there was Ethiopia, there was China, there was Taiwan, there was all countries. So all of them could identify with that story, even though it relates very personally to my own family. Yeah. So that's what you want to find is if you think you have a personal story that could be turned into a book that others would read, mm-hmm. find what's universal in that story. Find what's going to make that story appeal to somebody who doesn't know your grandchild and people in the book.
Yeah. And you know, you touched on another thing that I was curious about, and you've already answered it to some extent. That is that you have a collaborator to do the artwork. And I guess that becomes part of it too, given the age group you're writing for. How important is the artwork that you include in the book?
The artwork is incredibly important, but interestingly, and this is another thing that new authors will often say, well, I can't find an illustrator. Well, you don't find the illustrator. The publisher does. and in fact, the editors do not want to receive a manuscript with illustrations. They want to receive just your manuscript. And they'll find the illustrator. You may get to have a say. And in our case, Susan Roth was already widely published before we ever got together.
Mm-hmm.
So she went to her editors and said, okay, I've got this project. I'm the illustrator. Here's the author. So I sort of had a backdoor into it.
So in other words, it's a bit of a reverse situation.
Correct.
There.
But that's not usual. So if anybody listening out there wants to write a children's book, don't worry about finding the illustrator. The editor will take care of that. Just make a really fine manuscript.
And I guess, you know, I've looked recently just because, I used to read novels that were really long. I mean, for example, if you read Shogun, the paperback version of Shogun back in the day was like 1,200 pages long, right? And then all of his books were long, James Clavell's. And these days, when you look at some of these guidelines for novels, for example, a lot of them just say you're looking at 250 to 300 pages. And in some ways, for me, it seems like a short book for adults to be reading, but that seems to be the case. So I guess the question is, in your age group, I mean, you've mentioned like 600 words or whatever. What's their general advice on how many words, whether it's word count or
that sort of depends on the type of book. Mine are in the thousand word range, but that's because they're pretty meaty content.
Okay,
there are lots of books that may have one or two words on a page.
Oh.
And the focus is really the illustration.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously they have 32 pages, they may have fewer than 100 words, but those words are really carefully selected.
Yeah.
And they go with the illustrations.
Right.
But it, to your point about adult readers, this article in Atlantic also mentioned that the books Americans are reading are getting much shorter.
Yeah.
And not only are the books shorter, the sentences are shorter. We're reading much less complicated. You think about sentences by Dickens or James Joyce. You know, the sentences can go on for half a page. Well, we don't do that anymore. We don't read that way anymore. And the bestsellers, the New York Times bestsellers, are much simpler books than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Well, I, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about like the Ken Follett novels that are really long books.
Yes.
Great books. And thinking about how long they are. And I don't even think about how long or short a sentence is. And maybe I need to stop and think about that a little bit as I write. But it's interesting. I do know that there are plenty of articles now that adults, just in general, are reading a lot less. And so I guess it does say that everything's changing from the perspective of if you're a writer, maybe the world of readers that you're hoping to attract is much smaller than it would have been. Even though the population is larger, it's a smaller percentage of people actually reading books of any kind.
Well, and reading for pleasure. I mean, we're all reading probably more. I mean, between all the stuff that we're reading online and the social media and the emails that we read, we're reading plenty of words. It's like we're getting our steps in, we're getting our words in, but the complexity of what we're reading is way down. The classic.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting now, for example, we're all going back and reading the Odyssey now that we've got
the movie
out there. And some versions of that can be quite complicated. Mm-hmm. And every now and then there'll be a movie, a Shakespeare in Love, and people will go back and read Shakespeare. Well, Shakespeare is difficult to read.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be seen anyway. But I think we are reading, we're not reading as much fiction. And so it makes it harder. And I do think I think authors, and I would be curious if some of the best selling authors who've written for maybe 20 or 30 years, if they're writing, if you ask James Patterson, are his books shorter today? I don't know.
He could probably get away with doing what he's always done.
Well, probably when you're at that level, you can.
He can probably do that. It's kind of like Ken Follett, His books are his books, and that's the way they are. But I think you're right. If you're new to it, then you're going to be told to shorten things up, simplify things, so on and so forth. But then for me, and that would be removing the challenge of what I'm trying to write in some ways. The story I want to write is the story I want to write. It's kind of strange from that perspective. And from my perspective, the other thing is I go into it realizing that if I'm lucky, 20 people may really love the stuff, right? I mean, I think you and I both know Jeff Higgins.
Yes.
And here's a gentleman who's written many books. He's successful. And yet, I mean, it's not as if he earns enough, I don't think, because he does have another job. I mean, he writes around the job he has during the day because I think when I spoke to him, he said, well, if you think about how many ISBN numbers are issued in any given year, they're in the millions.
Right.
And of those millions of books or authors that are out there writing, there's only a handful that actually make a living writing just because that's the way it is.
That's right. Well, the publishing industry is very complex, and royalties are a tiny percentage.
Yes.
People think, you're selling books. Well, I may get a dollar in a book. So you have to sell a heck of a lot of books before you're making any money. And you're also paying for publicity. I mean, the marketing department of publishers, whether you're children's books or adult books, they're actually publicizing the authors who are already famous.
Exactly.
Those are the ones who have the stands at Barnes and Noble and the big posters and the tours and all of those things. Those of us who are mid-list or below are paying for all that ourselves. So you're absolutely right. There aren't very many who are making a living doing this. They're adding some income, but they're not living on this.
Yeah. I think going back to the theme that Hope threw at us about writing well, it goes back to the issue of, yes, we write, we draft our manuscripts and keep going over them and over them. Writing well requires us to keep perfecting or improving what we've already put on the page. So do you have an editor, a true editor at the publishing house, or is it you and someone else that really try to refine it before?
There's an editor. We've had three different publishers for the three. All three have been collaborations with Susan Roth, and all three have been different publishers.
Mm.
And the publisher we had for Zamzam was particularly instrumental in asking questions on every page. Zamzam I want to know more about what Zamzam feels. I want to know what he's thinking. I want to, she would ask questions and I'd have to go back and think about it.
Yeah.
And think, how do I want to express that emotion that he was feeling right at that time?
Mm-hmm.
And so, sometimes I would go to the source. I'd go to my grandson and say, what, you know, and that's whether that's your source or whether, you know, whatever the source is for your, whether it's your mind or however the source, however you define the source for your book.
Yeah.
You go back to that and you, if you're lucky, you have a really good editor who turns, our editor was Winsome Bingham with Raycraft Books. And she also writes her own children's books, and she's excellent at writing and also at editing. And she, you're lucky you have a really good editor who doesn't write the book for you, but asks you the questions to enable you to improve your manuscript.
Yeah.
And you'll
yeah.
always have an editor with the publisher. And we're talking about traditionally published books, not self-published books, but you'll always have an editor. And sometimes they are really good and sometimes they just want to get the project done. But
right.
I've had good editors at all the publishers I've worked with.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. When I was doing my legal books, and I had a pretty good legal publishing house, that we did it for 15 years.
Wow.
But what was interesting was, even though it was a legal professional book, a treatise, and it was a, you know, one of the top legal publishers around, to be honest, I mean, other than formatting and stuff like that, we really didn't have an editor, even for a project like that. And we did that for 15 years, and it got to the point where the volume between our analysis of the legal provisions as well as inserting the actual legal, you know, the regulations, the laws, the treaties that we were talking about, writing about, they rarely touched any of our actual texts that we generated our own. I mean, it was really interesting how they didn't do the editing. So I was actually thrown by that at the first year or two. And then once I realized that all they cared about was all of that material, and it ended up at the end, I think it was over 1,000 pages of material by the end of it. But after 15 years, I just said, I think I'm done with this, you know, because it really was an everyday kind of thing to look at everything going on globally and see what we were going to use for the following year's edition. But it was a rather eye-opener for me that even for as large of a legal publishing house as we were working with, other than formatting material, and because we also had to tell them the order of the appendix material that we wanted. And I mean, that's how much we had to do. It wasn't really the editors of the publishing house doing any of that. So,
were they fact checking your work at all?
Not really. I mean, that's what was so astounding. I think that it really was doing very little. I mean, now, because it was a legal book, I mean, it was very heavily footnotes, stuff like that. I mean, I don't know, on some pages, you'd have a couple of inches of just footnotes at the bottom of the page, as well as all of the appendix material. So from that perspective, it was really interesting. And then I did a separate standalone book with the same publisher, and it was the same thing. I mean, it was truly minor little things here and there, but as far as what we would consider real editing, it was practically zero. And I was...
That's funny. And that's the reverse with children's books. And sometimes, again, people think they're simple and nobody pays much attention to them. But the editors, the editor we had for our second book, which is a picture book biography of Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani teen. And this was published by Lee and Low, which is a major small publisher, especially for diverse authors or subjects. And in that case, the editor we had was a fine editor. She was a fine editor, but she was fact-checking everything. She wanted to make sure if I had a quote in there, where did I get that quote?
Yeah.
you don't footnote a children's book, but you do list your bibliography at the end. But for her, for that editor, I had to show her exactly where that quote came from.
Yeah.
And in a couple of times I had modified the quote, or I had left a word out just because I to take it because I wasn't wanted to give context to it. And we had to modify it so that it was exactly what the reference was. It's interesting because you think, oh, well, it's a children's book, it doesn't matter. But in that case, it mattered more. We had to make sure that we had everything perfectly accurate and documented for that book. So it can be interesting. As I say, it's not a simple process. It just because it's for kids, you can fluff it off a little bit.
So do you take some time between projects, or do you kind of have an idea of what the next project's going to be when you're done?
We do. We have an idea, but we're not, as I say, we're not making a living on this.
No.
And so it doesn't, we don't have a, but before we've actually got a manuscript, we don't have a deadline.
Yeah.
So we're actually trying to write a follow-up, sort of a sequel or another story about kids in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working on it, but we both have a lot of other things going on, and this isn't the only thing we're working on. So
right.
But we hope to have another one. But my grandson is certainly looking for another.
Does that add some pressure on you when
yes, it does.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. he's very funny. He's 9 years old, and he asked me after Zamzam came out, he asked me if I knew what the word merch meant. And I said, yes, it's merchandise. And he said, well, do we have any Zamzam merch? And I think he's 9 years old, you know, and he doesn't have a phone. He's not on the screen all the time, but he already knew what merch was. And he thought we ought to have, you know, baseball caps with camels on them and T-shirts with pyramids. And he had all sorts of ideas. So he's definitely waiting for the next book. And
well, he sounds to me like he could be your marketing manager.
Yes, he could be. Yes, very definitely. He comes and reads with me when we do events at bookstores, and it's quite a lot of fun.
Yes,
so
yeah. So. No, but so it's I guess, you know, the whole writing thing at this particular point. I mean, obviously, it's not a full time thing, but once you start, I guess, then it becomes a full-time thing, right?
Yes, and certainly once you get it, because then you're sort of stuck in the middle and you're thinking about it all the time, right? Until you get that next phrase, or you know there's a scene that you want in there and you've got to write it just right. So yes, whether you're swimming or walking or driving down the street, you're focused on that until you get it the way you want it. And then, of course, you send it to an editor and they come back and say, well, change all of that. So.
Yeah, I don't, like you said earlier from the article, the Atlantic article, it's, if people are reading less and so on, it really does make one question, as far as I guess I'm looking at it more from the adult fiction perspective, is, you know, how much will publishing houses really invest in having editors and so on and say, we really want to see almost finished, you know, publishable manuscript before we say yes to, certainly for new writers, it becomes a challenge if you're not, because they're focused on the established folks that they know are going to sell.
That's right. And there, a number of the publishers, especially the small ones, are willing to try a new person, but you do, yeah. You are advised to send a manuscript that you believe is your best work and is ready to be published.
Yeah.
And then they'll take it from there.
Yeah. It sounds to me like you're in the situation where you're actually getting editors that are really involved and want to be part of the process more so than what I'm seeing on the other side, perhaps.
That's true. And I think sometimes you have an editor you really like who's really good, and other times you don't. But most good children's authors have good editors.
Yeah.
And they collaborate with them. And many authors, especially older ones, they repeat with the same editor. You know, they have many mm-hmm. books with the same editor. We happen to have had three different editors. That's not as common sometimes. And part of that is because we've had different kinds of books. But I do think children's authors do work very closely with their editor.
Yeah. What would be your advice if somebody said, "Oh, I want to be a children's book author writer"?
Read children's books. I think if you that's the first thing. And then the second thing is to join SCBWI, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, because they have so many resources.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the feeling discouraged after you read books about writing. But I think you can take the classes and the webinars and be in conversation with editors and agents and other writers. And it's encouraging. Most of those webinars want to help you become a writer. They're not there to present you with so much information that you don't ever want to try it.
Yeah.
So, and it puts you in a company. They all have regional and national conferences, and you go and you have a wonderful time meeting with all these authors and editors, and you sort of feel like, oh, these are my people.
Yeah.
And it's it's good. And I'm sure it's similar if you go to a convention of mystery writers or a convention of, you know, whatever, or an author's guild. I mean, that's sort of the guild for all types of authors. And they have conferences and conventions as well. And you meet other people. And just like anything you do in life, when you meet people who care about the things you care about, you have conversations that feel encouraging.
You
don't come back from those feeling so discouraged that you're never going to write again. You come back with them with some energy and some inspiration.
Yeah.
Want to figure out that character and see what you want to do next.
I think you're absolutely right. When I spent on Saturday, I was at the event that Hope hosted, and I was sitting and chatting with Chris, who's another writer. And even though he's written many more books than I have, you know, we talk, and he has the same obstacles, shall we say, or hurdles as he writes as somebody who's writing their first or second book. So those hurdles and obstacles exist no matter how many books you've written, because now you're onto something absolutely new, which is a new project.
Right.
And every new project presents itself with new sets of challenges.
Right.
So,
right.
And I truly loved it when I did a podcast with him a few months back. And he said, well, he's a pantser, and he doesn't go and have a detailed outline that tells him exactly where the book's going every step of the way before he starts. He starts writing, and of course, that means that things just pop up.
Right.
And you go with it. And I was kind of happy to hear that, because he's written so many more books than I have, and I'm pretty much the same way. It's not that we don't do the research, thinking, okay, this is the stuff I need to collect before I ever start writing, because this is where I think my book is going to go, my story is going to go. But as you get going, you realize, you know, the story starts to move in a direction you hadn't anticipated sometimes. And then you got to say, well, I got to stop and look up some things, because I didn't expect this slight curveball here that came out of the blue. I don't know how much that happens in children's books, but it certainly happens in mine all the time.
I think it happens in mine is because they're a little more nonfiction. There's not, I mean, I do research, and there'll be times, you know, in the middle of it that I have to go find out a fact. But what I do find, and I've heard this from certainly a lot of children's authors, but adult authors as well, where you've introduced a character, and pretty soon the character is telling you what he's going to do next.
Oh, yes.
And you're nodding. So I think happens. That happens a lot. I mean, and sometimes, you know, Jacob told me what he was going to do, and it wasn't what I'd planned for him to do at all. So I had to go, you know, figure out, you know, how to get him there, you know, whatever it is. And that seems to be very common. These characters become very real and pretty much inhabit your mind. And, you know,
I write
the book for you.
I've definitely had that happen more than once or twice for me. I mean, it's I've had a nameless person in a chair become one of my primary characters in two books. You know, at first it was just having a female in a room, and from that it went on to something completely different.
So he was a significant character.
Oh, yeah. I was just absolutely stunned, and I had to go back and change a couple, not just a couple of things, but I had to go back and really give her more of the
make substance. It fit. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I had to create a backstory for her she's an illegitimate child, but you know, you had to give the father a backstory to justify why she was even here.
And, only in 10 chapters, you didn't know you were going to write.
Yeah. So it became a major part of the book. And then she ends up being in a second book, that follow up. So and frankly, I mean, I think that kind of interesting incidents in writing wouldn't happen if you detailed it to the point where there were no surprises along the way.
That's right. Yeah. And sometimes I think even people who outline, you know, they're willing to throw away the outline if a character comes, like, you know, introduces herself or himself and wants to have a more major role in the book, you can suddenly either add chapters or change the outline. So,
I mean, certain scenes have to be completely rewritten or changed. I've had that happen. And those are the things that make the whole book interesting for the writer, you know, because you go, oh, I was not expecting this to happen. and certainly, I mean, let me ask this question, because when you have a beginning and an ending kind of in mind, do they tend to start and end in those places, or are there drastic changes?
Not necessarily. Now, in a nonfiction book, you're sort of, mine have been written chronologically, so I'm sort of starting at the beginning and finishing at the end, and the same with the library book, which is had a beginning and an ending. So those had logical beginnings and endings.
Yeah.
The book about my grandson was a little, I really didn't know how that was going to
happen. Oh, okay.
And I was just sort of recounting all these funny stories and funny incidents. And then I had to think about it, and then I didn't outline that at all. And then I just sort of ended up where I wanted to end up. And I was very glad with the ending, but it was not something, I didn't start out with that. It has a message, but it was not a message I started out teaching. It, the little boy at the end, he's seen his grandparents in America. He's seen the grandparents in Egypt. And at the end, he sees them all in his dreams all together, because we're all under the same moon.
Yeah.
So it sort of ended up a very nice message, but it's not one that I didn't set out to say, okay, this is the theme of the book. This is sort of where it ended up.
Yeah, no, it's always interesting to have these conversations with writers. It doesn't matter what we write. It's just a journey that we tend to go through from start to finish on a project. And it's always fun and interesting to talk to other folks, because you go, well, maybe I'm not doing everything wrong. I might be getting one or two things right. Still a lot of improvement. And, you know, every project hopefully pushes us to write well and write better. And certainly when you have a few readers out there that are committed to reading that next book, it's encouraging. And it actually, I think, gives us a little momentum to keep going.
Keep on going. That's right.
And so hopefully when when we present that next project, it's well written. And they'll say, well, when's the next one coming out? Which is right now what I'm dealing with my publisher. So, but any last comments to anybody about children's books that
no, just keep reading. And and we certainly, the other big issue facing authors of children's or adult books is books being banned, and we don't want to launch a whole new topic, but I do want to say we need as many books on those library shelves as possible, so that everybody can choose the book that's right for themselves or their child. So
if you don't want to read something, don't read it.
That's right.
It's as simple as that, right?
One good sign, we've got the National Book Festival coming up, and here in the Washington area, we're lucky to have that, and it'll be August 22nd this year at the Convention Center. And last year, 75,000 people attended that, and those are people who are interested in books.
Yeah.
And yes, they may be reading ebooks, they may be listening to audiobooks, but they're interested in what we're writing.
Yeah.
So that's a really good sign. And we just want to make sure that what we're writing has a space on the shelf, and that we can all keep buying and going to the library and reading books.
Yeah. Well, no, absolutely. So, well, good luck to the next project, and hope it
goes
well. And I'm sure I'll see you around. By the way, for the people listening, Karen and I do live in the same condo building. So interesting. So thank you for being available and willing to talk about children's books today.
Thank you very much. It's been a wonderful conversation. Yeah, thank you, Tim.
Yeah, I love it. Two of my favorite writers, Tim Trainer, the podcast of the day for Timothy's Travails, and Karen, thank you so much for Zamzam. I absolutely love that.
Thank you.
And for the work you're doing with children's book authors. Also, thank you both for the shout out to my event on August 8th. We had the Incandescent Kids Magazine Children's Book Fair and first birthday party for the magazine. Tim, thank you so much for being there. And Karen, we look forward to bringing more children's books in front of as many children as we can. So thank you both. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV. Check out timothytrainer.com, and you can find Karen all over the internet as well. Actually, Karen, give us a shout out. Where can people find you?
You see the name on the screen, Karen Leggett Abaraya. It's just karenleggettabaraya.com. And there's a list. In addition to information about the books, there's information on writing resources for children, for young writers, including Incandescent Kids. So
thank you.
Have a young person in your house or your family, send them there, because there are lots of opportunities for kids to start writing early.
And you are featured on Incandescent Kids. So we're just going to have to keep this love fest going. So pick up a book, check out Zamzam, Z-A-M-Z-A-M, and you are going to absolutely love this book and her, and go on down the rabbit hole to find both of these fantastic authors. Thank you all. We'll see you all next month on Tim's Travails.